EcoShot Radio, broadcast and podcast. Find us on the web at ecoshock.org.
The birth of Gaia.
Why worry? The bugs will survive. In the previous session, we explored the beginnings of the Gaia theory. The originator of this hypothesis was Dr. James Lovelock, writing in his 1979 book titled Gaia, A New Look at Life on Earth. This book was Dr. Lovelock's first foray into the wide public debate. His funding came from the Shell Oil and Chemical Company. In his book, Lovelock explained that environmentalists exaggerate the dangers to life. Humans and large plants, he says, are just elegant salesmen, which we can do without. For example, why worry about ozone depletion? He says, quote, "The most essential part is probably that which dwells on the floors of the continental shelves and in the soil below the surface. Large plants and animals are relatively unimportant. They are comparable rather to those elegant salesmen and glamorous models used to display a firm's products, desirable perhaps, but not essential. The tough and reliable workers composing the microbial life of the soil and seabeds are the ones who keep things moving, and they are protected against any conceivable level of ultraviolet light by the sheer opacity of the environment." End quote. Don't you feel better, knowing the seabed microbes will survive our crazy chemical production? We made chlorofluorocarbons, the ozone killers, partly to power underarm spray deodorants. But hey, who needs humans if they are sterilized off the face of the earth by a thermonuclear war? Quote, "Nuclear radiation has lethal possibilities. If a nearby star becomes a supernova and exploded, would not the flood of cosmic rays sterilize the earth? Or what if all the nuclear weapons stockpiled on earth were exploded almost simultaneously in a global war? Again, we and the larger animals and plants might be seriously affected. But it is doubtful whether unicellular life would for the most part even notice such an event. There have been many investigations of the ecology of the Bikini Atoll to see if the high level of radioactivity resulting from the bomb tests there had adversely affected the life of that coral island. The findings show that in spite of the continuing radioactivity in the sea and on the land, this has had little effect on the normal ecology of the area, except in places where the explosions had blown away the topsoil and left bare rock behind." End quote. First of all, the environment of Ugalab, the island where the first hydrogen bomb was tested, is not normal. It has ceased to exist, having been vaporized into a mile-long trench under the ocean. The islanders themselves, for miles around, had to be evacuated for a generation. Secondly, the normal ecology of both Hiroshima and the Kiev area, as regards that life species called humans, was definitely adversely affected by atomic explosions. This is dangerous propaganda. During the mad Cold War standoff, scientists, perhaps feeling the guilty pinch of having created the nuclear terror we all lived, calmly tried to calculate whether we could survive a big exchange of nuclear weapons. Lovelock says, "Towards the end of 1975, the United States National Academy of Sciences issued a report prepared by an 8-man committee of their own distinguished members, assisted by 48 other scientists chosen from those expert in the effects of nuclear explosions and all things subsequent to them. The report suggested that if half of all the nuclear weapons in the world's arsenals, about 10,000 megatons, were used in a nuclear war, the effects on most of the human and man-made ecosystems of the world would be small at first and would become negligible within 30 years. Both aggressor and victim nations would, of course, suffer catastrophic local devastation, but areas remote from the battle and, especially important in the biosphere, marine and coastal ecosystems would be minimally disturbed." In the 1970s, it still seems that a nuclear war of major proportions, although no less horrific for the participants and their allies, would not be the global devastation so often portrayed. Certainly, it would not much disturb Gaia. End quote. It is hard to imagine local devastation. when a single 50-megaton three-stage hydrogen bomb spreads deadly radioactivity over more than 300 square miles. Just one bomb. Lovelock seems unaware of the nuclear winter issue, where the dust from such mega-explosion blocks out the sun, as volcano dust has historically done. The human casualties, he says, will not upset his Gaia. No algae will be harmed in this nuclear weapons experiment. This long-term scientism could be seen as a kind of psychological protection for the eco-shocked scientist, as well as a justification for making weapons of mass murder. It's all natural, they say.
The birth of guile.
Scientists have attempted to create a theory on how our atmosphere formed. The chemist Harold Urey computed that any primeval atmosphere would have been blown away in the earliest days of the Earth. Lovelock agrees, thinking that gradually a hydrogen-rich atmosphere collected, emerging from geologic processes in the Earth. Part of this theory involves the concept of oxidation, where free oxygen tends to interact with chemicals, such as iron, to form oxides. This is called reduction oxidation, or redox. In the early days of our atmosphere, there was far less oxygen than today. Lovelock considers this a development with biological causes. Without living forms to restore the current gas makeup of the atmosphere, eventually the hydrogen atoms, being light and active, would have escaped from Earth's gravity, leaving us with no atmosphere and no oceans. So Lovelock rested his case for Gaia, the organizing life force, primarily on the regularity of the climate. When Lovelock speaks of eons, he means a period of a billion years. He wrote, "The history of the Earth's climate is one of the more compelling arguments in favor of Gaia's existence. We know from the record of the sedimentary rocks that for the past 3.5 eons, the climate has never been, even for a short period, wholly unfavorable for life. Because of the unbroken record of life, we also know that the oceans can never have either frozen or boiled. Indeed, subtle evidence from the ratio of the different forms of oxygen atoms laid down in the rocks over the course of time strongly suggests that the climate has always been much as it is now, except during glacial periods or near the beginning of life when it was somewhat warmer. The glacial cold spells, ice ages as they are called, often with exaggeration, affected only those parts of the Earth outside latitudes 45 degrees north and 45 south. We are inclined to overlook the fact that 70% of the Earth's surface lies between these latitudes. The so-called ice ages only affected the plant and animal life which had colonized the remaining 30%, which is often partially frozen, even between glacial periods, as it is now. We may at first think that there is nothing particularly odd about this picture of a stable climate over the past 3.5 eons. The Earth had no doubt long since settled down in orbit around that great and constant radiator, the Sun. So why should we expect anything different? Yet it is odd, and for this reason. Our Sun, being a typical star, has evolved according to a standard and well-established pattern. A consequence of this is that during the 3.5 eons of life's existence on the Earth, the Sun's output of energy will have increased by at least 30%. 30% less from the Sun would imply a mean temperature for the Earth well below the freezing point of water. If the Earth's climate were determined solely by the output from the Sun, our planet would have been in a frozen state during the first 1.5 eons of life's existence. We know from the record of the rocks, and from the persistence of life itself, that no such adverse conditions existed. If the Earth were simply a solid, inanimate object, its surface temperature would follow the variations in solar output. No amount of insulating clothing will indefinitely protect a stone statue from winter cold or summer heat. Yet somehow, through 3.5 eons, the surface temperature has remained constant and favorable for life, much as our body temperatures remain constant whether it is summer or winter. It might be thought that the fierce radioactivity of the early days would be enough to keep the planet warm, In fact, simple calculations, based on the very predictable nature of radioactive decay, indicate that although these energies kept the interior incandescent, they have little effect on surface temperatures. End quote. Various scientists have offered explanations for how the Earth stayed warm enough for life in the early days when the sun was much weaker. Carl Sagan and Dr. Mullen suggested that gases, such as ammonia, helped to hold the sun's heat near the surface of the Earth. Others, such as Meadows and Sellers, wonder if the Earth was a darker color several billion years ago, and so retained more heat. Lovelock argued that early life used up essential chemicals over millions of years, locking them into their dead bodies, which would return into the geological crust and thus become unavailable. As a planetary adaptation, life forms emerged which would recycle such chemicals, maintaining their availability in the atmosphere and in the oceans. An interesting idea of early recycling by animals and plant life. A complex biological cycle helps keep the salinity of the ocean within the narrow limits required by life. Life has somehow managed to keep its atmosphere, climate, minerals, and oceans in a continuous cycle, rather than following the expected entropy, the running down that science would predict. These early organisms also had to evolve ways of handling toxic chemicals, such as mercury, in their environment, as well as in their own byproducts. Despite these wonders, Lovelock feels driven to explain human-made industrial pollution as a completely natural process. Quote, "Pollution is not, as we are so often told, a product of moral turpitude. It is an inevitable consequence of life at work. The second law of thermodynamics clearly states that the low entropy and intricate dynamic organization of a living system can only function through the excretion of low-grade products and low-grade energy to the environment. Criticism is only justified if we fail to find neat and satisfactory solutions which eliminate the problem while turning it to an advantage. To grass, beetles, and even farmers, the cow's dung is not pollution, but a valued gift. In a sensible world, industrial waste would not be banned, but put to good use. The negative, unconstructive response of prohibition by law seems as idiotic as legislating against the emission of dung from cows." End quote. But the good scientist here confuses cow shit, an adaptation that took place over millions of years, with strange man-made chemical and nuclear pollution arising in 50 years on a scale never before known on the planet. All very well to drop unconstructive responses of prohibition by law, so long as your children are not breathing the toxic chemicals, which reduce their intelligence and shorten their lives. What may be true in the long run can kill you in the short run, and we are not algae. Shell Research Limited, subsidiary of one of the largest polluters on Earth, got their money's worth by subsidizing Dr. James Lovelock. Since then, the Gaia hypothesis has traveled into two different streams. The idealists believe that all life is connected, existing as a superorganism which has its own purpose and sense of balance, even a sense of justice. Scientists stick to a more mechanical model. Here is a reevaluation of the Gaia theory from biologists Richard Leakey and Roger Lewin in their must-read book called The Sixth Extinction, Patterns of Life and the Future of Humankind. It was published in 1995. They say, quote, "Some Gaia enthusiasts extrapolated the theory to the point of suggesting that the Earth's biota is like a single organism, one with the purpose of maintaining itself. For this reason, the hypothesis was not taken seriously by biologists. It all seemed too mystical." Recently, however, ecologists have cut through the mystical fringe and acknowledged that Lovelock was correct. Just as the viability of individual ecosystems is maintained through the interaction of the species that compose them, so the environmental health of the Earth's biota flows from an interaction of all its ecosystems. The importance of the Gaia theory for our appreciation of biodiversity is profound. The theory's author told a major conference on the subject, quote, No longer do we have to justify the existence of humid tropical forests on the feeble grounds that they may carry plants with drugs that could cure human disease. Gaia theory forces us to see that they offer much more than this. Through their capacity to evapotranspire vast volumes of water vapor, they serve to keep the planet cool by wearing a sunshade of white reflecting cloud. Their replacement by cropland could precipitate a disaster that is global in scale. End quote. Predictions of global disaster aside, the core of Gaia theory has now been tested many times and vindicated. The balance of many chemical cycles, not just moisture, has been shown to flow directly from the functioning of ecosystems. Although there are many who still talk about the theory in mystical terms, Gaia has become serious science, and we are forced to take note of its importance. That's an end of a quote from Leakey and Lewin. While we may picture the material world, the rocks, water, and chemicals existing separately from life on the planet Earth, living systems are closely integrated with the non-living, so that one continually shapes the other. An Earth without life is inconceivable. Without life, there would be no soil, little if any cloud cover, and the rivers might run dry. In the end, despite its cold and careless birth, Gaia has spread far beyond its father. The new understanding of a planetary organization of life was raised to greater maturity by those who do care about humans and the fabulous living systems on our planet. That concludes our series on the birth of Gaia. For more, check our website at ecoshock.org.